Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know, we begin our show every day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. Not only did he testify during the impeachment hearing, but he was not exactly perp walked, but he and his brother were escorted out of the White House in February because, in fact, he spoke truth to power. Something that we learn in this administration, the operative word is you don't speak truth and you clearly don't address the power. So now the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So let me just remind everyone, as I do all the time now, we are Zooming this show on the day before we will actually hear it on Thursday, which means it's Wednesday. Why am I saying this? We've hit the 100,000 mark for the number of dead from COVID-19. We knew that that day was coming. That day is actually the day that we Zoom. We also know that there's a space shot that's about to take off. And I'm sure that as soon as we get off interviewing Mark, he's going to rush to the TV to watch. What I need to let you know, Mark Joseph Stern, and then I will begin this interview and begin this radio show, is that I was down at Cape Canaveral, Cape Kennedy, when Krista McAuliffe was supposed to take off that first time. But of course, because of the O-rings, they delayed it. And then I was in the New Hampshire legislature when she eventually took off. And we were literally all of us listening at the State House. And you heard this just incredible gasp because we heard it all at the same time. Just to give you an idea of how Krista McAuliffe and that space shot was so important, I look outside my window every day at the Krista McAuliffe Elementary School. That's my thread. All right.
You know, her husband, her widower, is still a federal judge in New Hampshire, by the way.
And
an excellent one.
And a wonderful, wonderful man. Mark Joseph Stern. I tell you, I want to like take a class with him, but I don't know if he teaches. But he does write for Slate.com. And I saw this piece that was entitled, Florida Judge Exposes the Chaotic Nightmare Facing Felons Who Want to Register to Vote. Now, let me just tell you something, Mark. I was over the moon when the Florida voters decided to return the franchise to former felons. I was like, wow. And it was a good number. It was a good vote. You know, they served their time. This was an obligation. Once you serve your time, you're back in society. And part of being back in society is to be able to participate in our democracy. So I was so happy. And then, of course, what I forgot was they had a Republican legislature. And the Republican legislature looks at the voters as the enemy, especially ex-felons, because most of them are probably Black or Hispanic. And the assumption is they ain't voting for me. So we have been sort of following this story. But your piece was fabulous, not only because of what this judge decided, but you gave us a little bit of the backstory about the criminal justice system in Florida. I do have to tell you, there was a paragraph that I read where I was just out of my mind about the fact that the criminal justice system is funded through a mind-boggling array of fines and fees imposed on everyone. I read this and I went, this isn't a sitcom. This is real. So with that, welcome to the program. Walk us through not only the judge's decision, but why this judge had to write a 125-page decision, because 124 pages wouldn't have done it.
Thank you so much. Yeah, this was a terrific decision. And like you said, you know, in 2018, Florida voters did a wonderful thing. It's my home state. I was so proud of them. They passed Amendment 4 by 65%, restoring voting rights to ex-felons, repealing a law that is from the Jim Crow era that permanently disenfranchised ex-felons. What did Republicans do? They turned around and said, you know what? We're going to basically undo this law, this constitutional amendment, by saying that ex-felons can't actually register to vote until they have finished paying all the fines and fees associated with their sentence. And like you just said, the problem here is that Florida literally funds its criminal justice system with these little fines and fees that might sound small, but truly add up. If you're arrested and you're charged in Florida, you've got to pay hundreds of dollars just to get a public defender. You've got to pay money just to appear before a judge. You've got to pay money to get your suspended license back. You've got to pay money to get health care in jail. You've got to pay money to get your analysis when you're released. You got to pay for everything. And here's the dirty little secret about that. The state knows that the vast majority of people can't actually pay that money. And the truth is that there is absolutely no kind of unified record of all of the court fines and fees that people owe in Florida. This information was left up to the counties, and the counties had horrible record-keeping practices, super sloppy. And so it's essentially impossible, if you were convicted in Florida, to figure out how much money you owe. And yet Republicans say you cannot vote until you pay back that money. Well, how are you going to be able to pay back money when no one can identify how much you owe? It's like a terrible catch-22.
That's the point. That's the point. Because exactly. The fear of not knowing whether you paid it all off means, because there's no way for you to even figure out how much you owe, is a reason why you won't vote, because you will be breaking the law if you don't pay it all up. And if there's no record and you can't figure it out, then they can threaten you by saying, well, you forgot this bill, or maybe you forgot that bill. I mean, just the fear of not knowing the entire amount means, why run the risk of voting?
Absolutely. You have to choose between exercising a constitutional right and potentially subjecting yourself to criminal prosecution for accidentally violating the law. And you're right. That is the point. I call this chaos disenfranchisement, right? It's very obvious that the attempt was to suppress votes by making people so confused, by injecting so much chaos into the process that people didn't feel comfortable registering because they were afraid that cops were going to knock on their door the next day.
I think the judge was reasonable the first time around. This is the same judge. Hasn't it come to him before? So yes. Let's talk about what he did the first time. And then let's talk about this 125-page decision this time. Because I think he's like, he's so ticked off.
I think so.
I think that's what this was. This was like, you guys did nothing, you know? Yeah. And now he has a full record of all this knuckle dragging and ineffectiveness and inability for anyone to be able to figure out what they owe. And this clearly really is about voter suppression.
Right. So the first time around, before there was a trial on this law, it was just a preliminary motion. The judge said, look, it is unconstitutional to disenfranchise someone because they can't pay a tax. These fines and fees are taxes. They are a violation, pretty clearly a violation of the 24th Amendment. They are pretty much a poll tax. And what I'm going to do is say, look, if you are indigent in Florida and you can't pay these fines and fees, then you can try to prove to the state that you're not able to pay them. And if you, the individual, can prove that you can't pay them, then you are allowed to vote. And that system is just impossible to implement when people can't figure out how much they owe. So the judge also told the state, you got to set up some kind of system here where you figure out how much people owe, you give them a way that they can pay it back, and then you have to let them prove to you if they can't pay it back, and then you have to let them vote. So basically, the judge was putting the burden on voters to prove that they were too poor to pay, right? So then the judge holds a trial on the law, and the state has months and months by this point to set up a system to figure out how they're going to do this. And so the judge puts these state officials on the stand and says, all right, so what have you done? And the state officials say, nothing. We have done absolutely nothing.
The chutzpah.
It was really almost intentional sabotage, because the Division of Elections would have needed 21 extra employees in order to set up any kind of functioning system. And that was a finding by the Independent Budget Analysis Office in Florida, right? That isn't just some propaganda. This is like cold, hard facts. You need an army of people to dig up all these records. How many extra employees did that division get? Zero people. It is currently facing 85,000 requests from ex-felons asking if they can vote. And over the last 18 months, how many of those requests has it responded to? Zero. It has not told a single ex-felon whether or not they are allowed to vote, because they cannot find the paperwork. During the trial, an attorney actually found the court ruling that forced this defendant to pay fines and fees, and no one could figure out how much it actually forced the person to pay. The attorney gave it to the director of the Division of Elections and said, look, just interpret this for me. Tell me how much the individual here has to pay to be able to vote. And she said, I don't know. I can't figure it out. And so after all of this, the judge comes back and he says, you know what? I think I may have given a little bit too much credit to the state of Florida, to the Florida government. And here's what I'm going to do instead. Instead of forcing people to prove that they can't pay, I'm going to tell people that they can send a request to the state asking them, do I have to pay any money or not? And if the state doesn't respond within 21 days, that person gets to vote. And that's the end of the story. I am not messing around here. I am not dealing with any more delay. And it was a really emphatic 125-page decision, because he had to go through all of the different ways that Florida had totally sabotaged this process, had made it impossible for these poor ex-felons to figure out what they needed to do to be law-abiding voters. And at the end of the day, the judge said, you know, this is just so unconstitutional in so many different ways. I have given you an opportunity to fix it, Florida. You refused. So now I'm going to be the adult in the room and fix it for you. And if you don't like it, too darn bad.
Well, so a couple of things are going through my head, but I want to go to the end first, and then I'll go back. And that is, you actually think this will be appealed, but you actually think that no matter where it goes, that even with Trump appointed justices, even with the Supreme Court, this is just so over the top. There is so much here that they would have to so contort themselves that there's no way that this decision won't stand. I mean, it's just so abusive. It's so like, I don't give a crap. They're felons. Why do I have to do anything? The fact that they didn't appoint enough people to actually do the requisite background work, the fact that there are 85,000 people that have applied and zero have been done. I mean, those things are outrageous. And in a lot of ways, Mark, what's so depressing about this story was not only was it written and fabulous, and you gave us the story and the level of outrage, it's like this should be front page of every newspaper. This should be the first story on MSNBC. This should be, and you know why? Because we're talking about bird watching while black. And we're talking about, you know, the guy with the 20, we're talking about all these things that have happened to people of color. We know that so many of these ex-felons are Hispanic or black. We know that this is a subtle way of once again disenfranchising them. This is another way of treating them as inferior human beings. Let's be honest. And you say that you think that if it goes up and gets appealed, that you really think that this judge's decision will stand. You really believe that? You're not just like blowing smoke. I want to believe it too.
I really do believe it. You know, I'm not going to put money down on it, because with Trump judges, you're always rolling the dice, of course. Yeah. It's a sign of a really good trial court judge to build up the kind of record that the judge here built up, Judge Hinkle. You know, he could have kind of cut corners here. He could have just issued a kind of cursory decision saying, this is a poll tax, this can't stand. And instead, he took the long route, and he made the civil rights advocates here prove to him why he should block this law. You know, he forced the voting rights attorneys to spend months compiling this record. And then at trial, he was very active. You know, he helped to question the state officials who were in charge of it. He made sure that there was this just undeniable record of malfeasance, really, by the state of Florida, of absolute negligence by the state of Florida, so that I think a higher court judge who is looking at this case is not going to want to stick his neck out and defend what Florida did here and stand up for the sovereign authority of the Florida legislature, because this really isn't just about voting rights. This is about the legislature trying to sort of pull one over on the courts and do this backdoor poll tax and then just assume that the courts are going to rubber stamp anything it does because, you know, Trump has filled them. So what could go wrong? And I really don't think that there are many judges on the bench who are going to want to stick their necks out to defend Florida's conduct here. It's just, it crosses so many lines.
Oh God, this story, I was telling my producer, I want to punch a wall. I was so exhausted and so angry at how obvious they were. I mean, in a lot of ways. I mean, they couldn't calculate the money. They hadn't actually processed anything. They did nothing. It was a joke to them, you know? And again, remember, the people voted for this. It was a referendum. They said, yes, we want these people's rights restored. So let me just ask another question. I don't know whether this came up during the course of the trial, but as I'm thinking about this, it also seems unfair. So you want these guys to somehow pay every fine, every bill, everything. They have to somehow have a complete blank record of owing anything to the state. So if I have 100 parking tickets and I haven't paid for them, and I've been parking in Miami, you know, for years and never pay a bill. If I have, I mean, think of all the people who owe taxes, owe parking tickets, owe speeding tickets, owe whatever. Do they get treated the same way?
So
if we have the same requirement that they have to completely prove that they paid up all their bills before they get to exercise the franchise, or is it just these felons?
So it only applies to felons, so people who've committed felonies, but I'm really glad that you brought that up, because one of the issues that came up at trial is that people are often charged with and convicted of both felonies and misdemeanors at the same time, right? You've got different counts, different charges, and what Florida courts did for quite some time is when they assigned fines and fees, they did not specify which ones were connected to a felony and which ones were connected to a misdemeanor. So one of the issues that arose at trial was you have these records that said, you know, this ex-felon owes X amount of money, but it didn't clarify which went to the misdemeanor and which went to the felony. The problem there is that he only has to pay off the felony fines in order to be able to vote. So how is he going to know which ones he needs to pay off to be able to vote? How does he know if there aren't duplicates here, if they're not being charged twice for the same crime, which is something that's also happened, if they're being charged extra because there are multiple counts, you can end up owing more and more money to the state, and the state can just add on these charges, and it's impossible to know which ones you have to pay for and which ones you're allowed to ignore and still, you know, still be able to vote. So it's a real nightmare. And if you have a parking ticket in Florida, it's not going to affect you. But if you got into some trouble a while back in Florida and you think you've moved beyond it and you want to register to vote, you've got to be careful under this law, because, you know, there is a chance that you could have state attorneys knocking at your door saying you registered to vote, but you still have a $20 debt from when you were pulled over for drunk driving 10 years ago.
So I mentioned to you before that, so I had a fellow who helps me around the house, and he's an ex-felon, okay? And I was telling him about this story because I was so wild. I was like, oh, you won't believe this, Steve. So as I'm telling him this, he said, let me just share a little story with you, Arnie. He said, I was on parole, and I was told that if I had a job over the weekend, for example, and that I couldn't check in, as long as I was working and they needed me for that job, when on Monday, when I came back, I could then say I was working, and therefore it would be okay that I didn't check in on Saturday because I'd be checking in on Monday, and I would have documentation that I was necessary for the job over the weekend. He said, so on Monday, they said, you didn't check in. He said, I know, but I was told that if I could get documentation. And so they said, well, then you have to go back to jail for 2 weeks. And not only did they send him back to jail for 2 weeks, but they gave him an ankle bracelet for 18 months. And he said, Arnie, I did what I was told. I did what I was told. You know, I have proof that I was working. And so as he heard this, he said, this happens all the time. This happens all the time. You can't even figure out how to do right because they make sure that they undermine you all the time.
Right. They're called technical violations.
It just breaks my heart. But as I'm listening to you, you said they have 21 days to be able to somehow come up with a number that they have to pay. Is that right? Or proof that they're indigent. Did the judge require a form? How are these felons going to find out? Who's going to monitor the 21 days? I am so frightened about this because, you know, you and I understand that they're trying to create a system, but they don't have one. And so now my question is, who's responsible for creating this, you know, application form, make sure it's a 21 days, and that you get a letter that says you can vote and you're not going to jail again, or what, you're not going to break the law. Who's going to do that? Who's responsible?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it's going to be individual attorneys working with their clients, trying to fill out these letters, send them in. The judge actually said, if you can, send it in with an affidavit attesting that you are indigent. Those kind of things you really do need the help of a lawyer for. I mean, I don't think most people know how to do an affidavit by themselves. And so there is going to be a problem here because the state also doesn't have any clear procedure for accepting these forms, right? For processing them. And the state has already shown that it's not willing to implement procedures when Judge Hinkle tells it to. So I think for now, you know, the state's just going to appeal and try to get out of this. Assuming the decision does stand up on appeal, I could see down the road state officials just refusing to comply and Judge Hinkle ultimately issuing a contempt order for state officials who are not following his decision, like Kim Davis way back in the day. Right. You know, sometimes officials gotta do stuff they don't want to because a judge says that's the law. And it'll be very interesting to see if Hinkle needs to use the power of contempt to kind of bring these Florida politicians to heel.
So, Mark, real quickly before I let you go, how many people are we talking about?
1.4 million.
That's a lot of people.
That's many people.
Florida may even be in play in 2020.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
So, I know. I'm being funny. So what I'm trying to figure out, I can't imagine the Republicans not doing anything to roadblock this. They don't care if you get the franchise the day after the election, but before the election, they are going to make it such a challenging mountain to climb. I'm just trying to figure out whether there is time, to be honest with you, between now and November for something to get in place so that those ex-felons actually do get the franchise that in 2018 they were supposed to have gotten, but the Republican legislature prevented them from doing it. Because if nothing else, this is probably the most important election in our lifetimes. And the fact that they are going to be denied being able to vote in this, that is going to have a huge impact on their lives. Let's be honest with you, more than any other time, I think, in human history, practically. And I just see this as, it's a window, but it's a pretty narrow window.
Yeah, I'm definitely worried because, of course, the closer we get to the election, the more chance that the Supreme Court will step in and say, well, we don't want to be changing election laws this close to election day, so we're just going to keep all this on hold. You know, I think it's going to be close. I do think that it's going to be a mad dash through the appeals courts. The state's going to try to drag things out. The plaintiffs here are going to try to say there's no reason to stay Judge Hinkle's decision. There's going to be future brawls, right? And I would be disappointed if Judge Hinkle's decision is suspended through the election and then allowed to go into effect afterwards. That's not much of a help, is it? So I will bring you a bit of good news, which is that the state officials, or really local officials, county officials who care about voting rights, are doing everything they can to fix this problem. So in liberal counties like Broward County in South Florida and Miami-Dade County, judges have set up rocket dockets where former felons can walk into their courtroom, they stand before a judge, and the judge essentially waves a magic wand and says, you are absolved of all court fines and fees. And that is legal, that is real, that works. And there is a real possibility that hundreds of thousands of people will get that sort of absolution before the election. It's already been super popular and successful. It had to go on hold during COVID, right? So that is unfortunate. There is a real movement in South Florida and some of these more liberal counties to make sure these people can vote ASAP. So this is an all hands on deck.
The rocket docket? Is that what they call
it? That's it.
The rocket docket. Okay, wait. One more thing and then let you go. So can I move to that county? Like in order to, no, I don't mean me, but I mean, in order to get the rocket docket in those counties that you're describing, what is your nexus to the county in order to get before the judge in order to get the Rocket docket. I mean, I do a GoFundMe and move everybody to those counties just to make it happen. But I'm just trying to figure out if there's sort of an underlying requirement that you have to have lived here a couple of months or whatever, that there's a residency requirement for the Rocket.
You have to have been convicted there. That's the problem. Yeah. Now, the other side of it is that most people in Florida live in those counties. These are the four most populous counties in the state that have enacted Rocket dockets. Okay. So that is not as bad of a limitation as you might think. There's still going to be a lot of good coming out of this. Again, it is all hands on deck in Florida. If you care about the right to vote, Florida is the battleground this year. And like you said, it may just be a swing state as well.
Why we love Mark Joseph Stern of Slate.com, because after hearing this story, you care about Florida. You care about Florida. Here is an opportunity to give people the franchise that they deserve, that the voters wanted. Republicans have been trying to sort of interfere with this. There are solutions. The judge has given us a 125-page decision. I think I may have to read that. It's bedtime reading, if nothing else, Mark. Thank you so much for joining us. This is an incredibly important story, an incredibly important story. And because of all the chaos that's happening around us, we don't even have the bandwidth to sort of comprehend how important this is. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for caring. I'm always glad and I appreciate
it. Thank you, Mark. All right, everyone, stick around. We're going to talk about the SBA, small business. We supposedly love those people. Maybe not. All right, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. We'll be right back.
Invasive mussels muscle their way into the Great Lakes on this current cast. You might think a creature the size of a dime is no match for a freshwater system the size of Texas, but quagga mussels are prolific breeders. Multiply one by trillions, and you get mussels that can wallop even a big body of water. Native to Eastern Europe, quaggas, like their cousins the zebra mussels, barged in through the ballast water discharged from ships and were first spotted in Lake Erie in the late 80s. Quagga mussels feed year-round on plankton and other organisms, depleting food supplies for native fish, which can create a devastating domino effect in the food web. So finding a way to knock out these invaders is critical to preserving a healthy Great Lakes ecosystem. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
You know that time never sleeps. Keep one eye open like I got my head full of dreams. All shattered and broken like never chose love. It chose me, but I'm still here, making stones bleed. So I'll go on swimming upstream till I come tumbling down. Oh, and I'm working on faith. Oh, and you're living on faith. Something's got to give. Something's got to give. Oh, and you're giving your all. Oh, and it's coming up short. Something's got to give. Something's got to give. Gotta give a little more. Oh, yes. When the going gets tough, gotta give a little more. Oh, yes. In the name of the Father.
kick it up a notch.
Usually I wouldn't do this, but
welcome back to Parle Deux of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. The American Prospect. Love those people. Love their new editor, David Dayan. He's phenomenal. I mean, he's so prolific. I don't know how he ever sleeps. And they always bring in great reporters and people that sort of focus on things that I think are not only interesting but important and aren't getting enough attention. The article by Alexander Salmon is entitled, Everybody Hates the SBA. How did one of the most addled government agencies end up as our last line of pandemic defense? Well, that's probably because we don't know how to send money to small business, only to big business and wealthy corporations and whatever. So let me welcome Alex to the program. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with your story about the guy that owned three or four subways. His valiant effort at trying to get this money, because obviously he still may be able to sell his one footers. He's seen his business just basically get trashed because of COVID. And so even survival is questionable, but this guy thought he was doing everything right. He knew exactly sort of how he was supposed to behave. And despite that, his story is a story of frustration. And this is a guy that's probably got more sophistication than a lot of other small businesses. So why don't you start with his story, and then let's go back into a little bit about why the SBA was so unprepared.
Absolutely. So yeah, so we kind of start the story off with Harpreet Jima, who's a small businessman in Stockton, California. He owns three Subway franchises. When the pandemic hits, obviously there are stay-at-home orders in California, and his business takes a significant hit right away, and it's sustained as well. And so he is trying both to look out for his business and for his employees, and goes to great lengths to do this. It ends up on this quixotic quest where he's going to Home Depots all over the state looking for plexiglass covers for his employees to protect them. He at one point told me that he had to go 2 hours outside of town to even find the stuff. He couldn't get masks despite his supplier saying they were on the way. And so, you know, you kind of follow this guy through this incredible journey, and the journey through the SBA program is probably the most confusing and frustrating of the bunch. So he's someone who has accounts with a major bank. He has accounts at Bank of America. He has an established relationship with them there. And when the application for the Paycheck Protection Program opens, he applies right away, and then immediately receives notice that something is wrong with the application. It's not clear what it is. He can't contact Bank of America because they don't know. And the SBA says, don't contact us because we don't know. And so he goes through this process where he submits through PayPal, he submits through various other lenders. And at the end of 2 weeks, he gets a notification that the PPP has run out of money. And he, for his efforts, still has nothing to show for it. And so, again, it's basically cast back out to the whims of the business cycle and is hoping to hold on and basically, you know, can't make his rent and has to cut hours back at the mercy of a program that is you know, underfunded, utterly confusing, and not up to the task of saving these small businesses that, you know, in a lot of ways have done everything right, took the necessary steps, still need help to make it through and aren't finding it.
Well, I think the other thing that's also interesting is that the volume of money that the SBA is supposed to put out there is such a huge amount, given what they've historically done in the past and what they're asked to do now. I mean, they don't have the muscle, you know, they don't have the level of sophistication to be able to do it. And you then start telling the story and the history of the SBA, which is a really depressing story, because the title of it is Small Business. But what happens is big business suddenly goes, oh, there's money there. How do we make ourselves look small in order to be able to access this money? And a lot of your story is about how these places that should never be getting a Small Business Administration loan, have never fit into whatever the definition is, have managed because of lawyers and accountants and everything else, been able to redefine themselves so they qualify for SBA loans. I mean, that's the other problem. We kind of knew that there would be things that would like make us want to take a shower, but this seems to be not just happening now. This is kind of historic, Alex.
Yeah, absolutely. So the SBA is an interesting institution because many, many departments in the federal government are created in a moment of crisis, whether it's the Department of Homeland Security comes out of 9/11 or Housing and Urban Development comes out of the housing crisis. The SBA comes out of a moment where arguably small business was never more powerful than it was at that time. In this almost 70 years since that administration was created, small business's power has waned dramatically. And so since its establishment, you have a moment where small business needs help, certainly. But what ends up happening is exactly as you said, large businesses, it really starts out with fast food franchises, see that there's plenty of money on offer. And if they can just tap this credit line that the federal government has established for small business owners, they can actually grow their business with basically no downside to them. And so starting in the 70s, we see this with Ray Kroc, who's the founder of McDonald's. He realizes that, well, because of the franchise model, he can circumvent the monopoly rules that exist on expanding his business, and he can get the federal government to underwrite the expansion. And so you see, he was a great pioneer of this under the Nixon administration. And as the years progress, you see a number of other restaurant chains get in on it. You see 7-Eleven and Subway and all these places, but also car dealerships and various large businesses ultimately realize that there's a nifty chunk of change. Exactly. The SBA and they want in on it and they end up getting it.
Let me just read something from your article because I want people to hear this history because you describe it as picking the lock, which I love. But anyway, you write, franchises were initially considered, in the words of the then administrator Eugene Foley, distribution outlets of large businesses. Yes, I agree with you. But in 1966, the SBA succumbed to lobbyist pressure from the International Franchise Association and changed its rules, which overnight set it on its current path toward corporate capture. The SBA now actually gives special preferences to aspiring franchisees, despite the fact that the failure rate of Subways and 7-Elevens is much higher than that of the average independent small business. In 2014, 43% of first-time franchisees obtained financing from where? SBA loans. And as you pointed out, the chain restaurants had picked the lock. And that description is so important for people to hear because the level of frustration and fear about what to do. And then on top of that, they're supposed to somehow use most of their money to keep, you know, 75% of their employees on the payroll. And yet, you know, what about all the other bills they have to pay? And then they're afraid of buying masks and making things safe because they have to pay payroll. But then how do you buy a mask? I mean, they are now being contorted in ways that is just so incredibly unfair.
Yeah, that's right. And you see kind of in the two waves of funding of the PPP program, you see basically this entire array of issues spread out before us. So the first wave, the money dries up way too fast. And most of it goes to large corporations, to groups that have pre-existing relationships with large banks, and people who you would say arguably do not need the money, are basically no need. Some of them are corporations with multi-billion dollar valuations. Then in the second round, when Congress replenished the fund, the opposite happened, and small business owners were then so afraid of violating the terms of loan forgiveness, which are so confusing and so hackneyed and so all over the place, that they're actually scared to use the money on the off chance that they get it. And so, as you mentioned, they don't want to buy too many masks, because if they spend too much money on masks and protective equipment, then they might break that threshold for 75% payroll, and then they're in debt and they start paying this off with interest. And so in the second wave of funding, which is much less money, there's still money left and it hasn't run out, and it was expected to run out quickly and it didn't. And that's a whole nother issue, which is that now business owners are scared to use the funding for fear of, you know, punitive measures of bank fraud, of any number of clawback campaigns that are kind of gaining steam a little bit now within Congress and have kind of grown out of the widespread consternation over this program.
But there was the other thing that was also interesting is that there's a big bank, little bank difference, in the sense that if you were a community banker, you knew how to get that money to people who needed it. You were able to sort of work with them. The large banks didn't have relationships with most small businesses, or maybe some faux small businesses that were able to package themselves as so you begin to see just who got the money. You know, when you begin to look at who gets the money, you're kind of like, wait a minute, this was never what the intent was. The intent was to get it to people who were really struggling, not people who have like an asset cushion of, you know, a couple of $100 million. That's not small to me. And I don't know, you didn't put this in your article, but I believe one of the best places in the country to get PPE money out to small business, real small business, not the faux small business, is North Dakota. Because North Dakota has a state bank, everyone, the Bank of North Dakota. And as a result of this state bank, they know their peeps, you know, they know their people. And there is an example of, here's the money, but it's not just the money is being provided. You need to make sure that the bankers that are actually putting that money out know how to develop relationships. And I believe you wrote in your piece that some bankers got so frustrated that at one point, one of the bankers said, oh, hell with us. Just give the money directly to businesses. Cut us out of this mix. I mean, when you hear a banker say, cut me out, I'm thinking, what does he know that I don't know? But that's the level of frustration that even this banker is realizing, I'm now an impediment to helping these small businesses. And I know that in the end, they actually are important, but for whatever reason, I'm not providing them with assistance. I'm actually undermining their ability to figure out how to survive.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And the role the banks play in this is very significant because, yeah, as you mentioned, the public banking system in North Dakota was quite effective in getting money out. So, you know, it's not an inherent flaw in the way this program was designed. The issue is that the amount of control that we've handed to large banks, their interest is not in, of course, seeing, you know, this basket of small businesses survive. Their interest is in serving their clients with the minimum possible amount of effort. And larger loans make larger fees, and companies with you know, elite banking services already have their fraud department looking at this sort of stuff. And so it minimizes effort for them. And it's just very obvious incentives that happens when you contract out these things to private groups, especially large banks. And that's a byproduct of the whittling away of this agency that's gone on for decades in a row now. And when you hand control over.
Right. But at the end of your article, I'm reading about the SBA and I'm exhausted by the time I get done reading it. I'm like so disgusted with them. I'm like, oh God, just throw them out with the bathwater. But at the end you say, but we need this organization. We need an effective SBA. That was sort of shocking to me because I guess I'm trying to figure out to get an effective SBA, one that has been so sort of, you know, been eroded over for such a long time. And it's not just eroded because of personnel. You know, it's eroded because, as you said, they knew how to pick the lock. So if we're going to have an SBA going into the future, we have to make sure that we put another padlock on and one that can't be so easily picked, or that it has to be so transparent that anyone who tries to pick the lock, you're going to immediately know this gazillionaire just picked the lock or this guy just picked the lock, which is what happened to some extent. We saw some very large restaurant chains get the money and they had to return it. We saw some, you know, very wealthy people get it and they had to return it. But that's just maybe the handful that we saw. I'm sure there are so many more than that. But you said the SBA should actually, it has an important role. What would you do, Alex? If you wanted to see an SBA after the November election, how would that SBA look different?
It's a great question. I think that if we look backwards a number of years actually to the administration that gave rise to the SBA, which is the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. It was a New Deal body. It was actually created by, it wasn't created by Roosevelt, but it was expanded by him drastically. And it became one of the more essential bodies of the New Deal, where it was able to not only give loans to rural areas and small businesses and people that were underserved by the banking community, especially people that were outside of the FDIC and some of the more traditional banking infrastructure that existed, but it even had the ability to buy shares and flagging companies and set them on a safer course. So it was a very active and empowered agency, and it played a really important role in a lot of the New Deal development, especially of rural America. So there was a time when we had agencies like this that actually did serve constituents, they served people, they served small business owners, and we don't have to go that far back to imagine what that looks like. There's evidence of that as a successful model in our not too distant history here. So I think, you know, if you were to take that as a model and say, well, let's look back at the RFC and see where it was successful, see how it worked and where it succeeded, and say, and make a real commitment to the idea that small businesses should be a part of the American economy or the American fabric of society. And I think, you know, with actual funding, with meaningful funding, with an expanded budget, with actual staffing, and with this kind of more imperial charter, you could see an SBA, you know, if the an SBA administrator who has a cabinet position could be empowered to do things that are meaningful anti-monopoly measures, and they could really affect the way the economy works in this country and level the playing field a bit. So, yeah, I think obviously the SBA as it currently exists is, I think, generously described as a backwater. I think there are a lot of people who would say worse things about it than that. But the idea of an SBA is not a fundamentally bankrupt one. I think it's one that is actually quite compelling and in an administration where this was a priority could play a real role.
Well, you know, as I'm listening to you, it again, one of the frustrations I have about the PPE is the idea of that, you know, you have to keep 75% of your payroll, you have to keep them on the payroll. And you and I both know that COVID's gonna last a long time. That what emerges on the other side is not going to look like the business that you started with. And one of the beauties of small business is that they are nimble, that they tend to be able to sort of try to change as the economy changes or whatever changes. And in a way, the PPE was kind of rigid in their expectation of what you were supposed to do. Yes, you want to keep people employed, but it may not be through the idea that the small business person has to keep this percentage of their payroll employed, because that may not allow them to sort of adjust to what is going to be a very, very different economy in 2021. You know that, and I know that. You know, when I think about restaurants, what do I think about restaurants? I think about they churn. They're constantly about churning. How many people can you get in? How many people can you get out? How many people can you get? Well, you can't do that anymore. Not until we have a vaccine, and maybe ever. No, the idea is that model is a historic model that doesn't work because of COVID. And so once again, I think that's part of the problem is that I don't think we quite appreciated what we're asking small business to do. And if small businesses are supposed to be responsive to what they're seeing happening around them, then what you just did was put a straitjacket on them. So there's also a fear of taking that money, not only because, oh, I can't spend the money on masks when they probably should, but if I have to spend 75% of it on payroll, and I know that that isn't going to make sense on the other side, then why would I take it in the first place? Does that make sense?
That's right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think it's worth comparing the PPP's program and its rules and regulations to the other large business bailouts that we've seen as part of the CARES package or the actions by the Fed even. So, you know, we have this suite of bailout responses, and for corporate America, for large corporations, there are very, very few contingencies in place for them to accept that money. I mean, they by and large have received money or have done bond rounds that have been underwritten by the Fed. You name it, they've accessed capital and an immense amount of capital with very, very few restrictions in place.
Exactly.
And on the other side of this, we have the SBA program, which I think is, you know, somewhat well-intentioned, but puts in place so many restrictions that it's almost impossible to use. And there you see, again, the different rules that these two sectors of the economy play by. And if, you know, if you're one of those companies that has access to lawyers and to big time funding, then you play by a different set of rules. And I think that's, you know, the fundamental inequality of our economy is very much on display in this particular corner of the world. And I think it's distressing and, yeah, concerning for a lot of reasons.
You know what this reminds me of? This reminds me, and this is, it's a sort of a side route, but it reminds me of the huge tax cuts that we gave to corporate America. And corporate America said, oh no, we're going to put it into capital investment. Oh no, we're going to put it into workers. Oh no. And what you find out is they put it into stock buybacks. I mean, there was no requirement. They sold a great storyline. Oh, think of what we can do for the economy if you just cut our taxes. And then you find out what they didn't do for the economy, but they did for their own paycheck, you know, or their own portfolio or whatever. And you get so frustrated because once again, we didn't put in any kind of constraints in that tax cut. And look what happened with the money. Look what happened when the Fed stepped in and helped big business. Look what happened when the little guy comes and says, I need $10,000 or I need $50,000. But then you tell them they have to go through all these different hoops in order to get that money. And those hoops basically mean you're not going to try. Because what it does is, it, as I pointed out before, it straitjackets you. All right, I got 2 minutes left. You wrote a piece about Stacey Abrams. Doesn't it, it does seem bizarre. I've never seen anyone really campaign for vice president. Stacey Abrams is really campaigning for vice president. Is she a case of first impression? Have people done that before other than Dick Cheney? I mean, and Dick Cheney didn't really even do it. Dick Cheney said, oh, I'll help you find the person. The only person I can imagine is me. But I mean, but it just seems so interesting that I feel, I'm not sure whether I think it's a great strategy or whether I feel like it's an uncomfortable strategy.
It's certainly bizarre. I couldn't find any historical precedent for that, and obviously Dick Cheney is without precedent of his own volition, but in a much different way. And yeah, the Stacey Abrams vice presidential campaign, I think, it's peculiar in a lot of ways, but especially because of the relative dormancy of the Joe Biden campaign. So to see someone, you know, running such a spirited campaign for it's essentially an unelected office in vice president. On the ticket with someone who really hasn't been running much of a campaign at all for president, or at least has run a fairly sleepy one. It is kind of a stark contrast, and it's something that, yeah, I don't think we've really seen before. I'm not sure what will come of it, but yeah.
It is unusual, and let me just say another reason why it's unusual, and that is that I think at the very beginning of Joe's sleepy campaign, because it was really sleepy in the beginning, he was being courted. He was courting her. He almost, at the very beginning of his campaign, thought, how do I give myself some adrenaline? How do I look like this is going to be a different campaign? And I think that there was actually an interesting courting by him of her. And then I think she thought what I thought, oh, you're never going to be the nominee. And she kind of said, I'm going to work on voting issues. And then Michael Bloomberg gave her all this money and she started working on voting issues. I mean, she's always been committed to voting issues. Don't get me wrong. This is where a lot of her heart is. I get that. But it's just so funny because he courted her, and now she is really wooing him. And just, again, it is a unique time in presidential campaigns, and these are things I'd never seen happen before. And I'm glad that you looked through the history books and said, yes, this is a case of first impression too. Because I was like, okay, I just was trying to figure out if I'd ever seen anyone ever do that before, and I don't believe I have. So, It'll be fascinating to see who he chooses. I absolutely think it'll be interesting to see. I know I saw the two of them on MSNBC, so I know that the public courtship with all the different candidates is probably going to start happening. And then the question is, you know, who do we think has the best je ne sais quoi? So fascinating. But thank you, Alex. This was a really interesting piece about the SBA. My sense of frustration was overwhelming, but I think you're absolutely right. If we really are going to have an economy that works for all of us, we probably need a better SBA because they're going to need to be partnering with small business because there's lots of challenges ahead and big business alone is clearly not the answer. So thank you so much for writing for the American Prospect.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, it's a deal. All right, everyone. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with producers Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. We will chat tomorrow. Ciao. You bet.